Good evening, this is Gary Kavner here on the right side. I'm on my own today, I'm afraid again. Michael Dwyer, my friend and colleague, is off chasing geese. Actually, I've made that comment a couple of times and I have got a couple of questions about it. I actually don't know what Michael does on his days off or where he just doesn't turn up. I just presume it involves geese in some ways because it fits with what I know of Michael as a person. Take that as you may. So, Michael, when he said he wasn't going to be here today, said that I could talk about anything I wanted. And he suggested, as I recently did an entire episode on why the death penalty should be brought back, suggested I should speak in favour of torture or slavery. And both of those are ridiculous statements. I would never make such a base and I would never make an argument so void of virtue. So instead, I'm going to talk about why we need to bring shame back and why society doesn't shame people enough, which is a much more virtuous thing. So, I was put onto this by an article I saw in the Irish Times, which was about fat shaming. It said that fat shaming was everywhere and doctors had to stop it, and there was fat discrimination and fat bias and whatever you have in yourself. And as someone who would be described gently as overweight, or would be described by those who didn't want to be gentle, or some would say just had a closer, shall we say, connection to reality as fat, I have a little bit of the skin in the game on this thing. I have a bit of an interesting reaction to all of this. There should be no shame. We should never shame people. Society has moved on from the days when we had to shame people. I actually don't think there's enough shame in a lot of society. Within certain provisos I'm going to lay out, and I'll invite anyone who's interested to make a comment on it, and then I may respond in the next one of these. There are two kind of shames you can have. You can have internal shame and external shame. Both are largely derived from social pressures and morality. Shame is at its core a sense that what you have done is wrong or negative or reflects poorly on you or your community or your people. Shame is immensely useful because shame tells you this is something you shouldn't do. It's something you shouldn't have done. It's not healthy and you shouldn't replicate shameful behavior. So if you see someone who is being shamed, you're being told, don't be like that person. And this in itself, I think, is rather sort of process thing. It can be good, it can be bad, depending on what you are being shamed for. So in the case of, let's say, fat, I am fat not because I have a disease or because I have anything. I'm fat because I eat like crap and I don't exercise. And to be honest, if I wanted to lose weight, I probably wouldn't even need to exercise. I would just need to fix the glaring nutritional deficits in my diet. I'm fat because I don't care about it. And if there was more social pressure, if there's actually a social shame to being overweight, I would change it. Because I work in a sector where perception, not public perception, because I don't really care what the public thinks of me, which is very useful if you're ever going to do anything public facing like podcasts or media. But it's important what my clients think of me. And my clients tend to come from a very particular social class. And if that social class thought being overweight was shameful, I would lose weight. That's the long and the short of it. I don't care at the minute because there's no cost on me and people will go, well, what about your health? And I will point to many behaviours I engage in which are also terrible for my health. And I'm kind of just surprised I wasn't stabbed at around 25 in a bar for saying the wrong thing to the wrong person or the right thing to the right person, depending on your view of that. But if this was costing me money through the form of social impact, I would absolutely change my behaviour. And here's the thing, being fat does have a health impact. All other things being considered, it is better not to be overweight than it is to be overweight. And people will say, well, I'm overweight and I'm perfectly healthy. There have been periods of my life where I've been thinner, there are periods of my life where I've been quite fit and have been thin, and periods of my life where I've been quite fit and overweight. But I'll tell you this, you walk up a mountain when you're fit and you're overweight, you will realize that, you know, if I did this and there was a little bit of weight on the knees or less weight on the knees, this would just be a whole lot more comfortable. It is very clear when you do physically demanding activities and you've seen the difference throughout your life that most things considered, it would be better to have a certain healthy weight. I'm not saying go full anorexia on this. And by that basis, if we think that people's health is important, shaming people who are fat is a perfectly acceptable thing. Because the job there is either two parts. You've A, to get the person to change their behaviour. Lots of times that's not going to work. Either because they don't care they're being shamed, or because they just don't want it. But it also serves a secondary function, which is to go to people who are not fat, particularly the young, and say, this is not how you should be. And I think that's perfectly acceptable. Now, obviously, there were instances in which years ago you'd be shamed for, let's say, being gay or something of that nature. Something which you had no control over, you couldn't change, and it appears other people have no control over either. So in that case, shaming is largely pointless. Now, if you are one of those people who are more in the sort of socialization idea of why people are gay, well, then you can make those arguments. They're not arguments, I believe. But shame is an important social function. It tells people what they can and can't do. And I think we now have this weird thing in society where people will do things that are clearly degenerate. And that's really only the word for it. They are destructive to the fabric of society, and from that, to the lives that other people will live. And then they will come out and say, well, you're shaming me. To which I think the only appropriate answer is, yes, we are shaming you because you should be ashamed, and you're not. So therefore, external shame needs to come. I mean, the level of permissiveness towards certain behaviour and certain ways of living that have started to creep in because you can't judge other people is ridiculous, because we know some of these behaviours will lead to worse outcomes for people, for children, for the wider community. I mean, for instance, let's say if you think that politicians aren't terribly good in Ireland, that they don't really seem to care about the issues. Shame is a wonderful motivator. If they are ashamed internally, they will do better. If they are ashamed publicly, to the extent it might cost them vote, by God, you better believe they'll do better. So I think the important thing here is deciding where shame can be applied, where it should be applied, and the level to which it should be applied. And I think there are tricky areas here, because an important thing to remember about shame is effectively saying pressure should be put on someone in order to improve the overall situation, which is to say that someone should be made worse off so that either they can eventually be made better off, partially against their will, or everyone else can be made better off. It is an argument to the common good at its core. So there are certain instances where one could say that more shame than is usually applied is applicable, but no one wants to do it because it seems deeply unpleasant and or heartless. An area that immediately comes to mind is drug addiction. We tried for many years to get people off drugs using pretty much pure shame, and it didn't work. It just did not work in the end. But now we've gone to the other extreme. Now we have reclassed drug usage, drug addiction, alcoholism as diseases. People are openly saying that these things are diseases, despite the fact that they do not meet the definitional requirements to be a disease. A disease is a medical term. You can stop being a drug addict by just stopping taking drugs. It's a choice. It's not a disease. But we class it as a disease because then it becomes something else. It becomes a lot easier to deal with, largely actually for people around addicts. So it's not John's fault that he robbed you, or it's not John's fault that he lied to you, or it's not John's fault that he engaged in some disgraceful behaviour because he wanted to get heroin. It's the disease. But it's not a disease. It's a pattern of behaviour. And when we say it's a disease, we remove agency from people. At the end of the day, it is their choices that have led them where they are, informed by their surroundings, but it is their choices. And it's their choices that will change that for them. So for us to say, well, it's a disease, is to say that you have no control over your own addiction. It is for better people than you to come and tell you, well, you do these things, or we'll give you these pills, and then you'll be cured of addiction. And I don't think that one is helpful either. I think there is actually a balance here, because you need to recognise that the things you have done were wrong, and that you should make amends for those things. But you should also recognise that it is in your control how to change, and there should be help provided, obviously. But I don't think this softly, you're not really a person because you're not in control of your own choices is actually going to help anyone, because at the end of the day, there are treatments that can detox someone from drugs forcibly. There are treatments that can detox someone from alcohol quite forcibly. There are some treatments that you can give to people that will make it very difficult for them to take drugs or alcohol again without quite painful physiological and consequences, like nausea, vomiting, splitting headaches. Pain. They are painful. But at the end of the day, that person can always make the choice to get around it or to work around it, or they can make the choice to stop. And I think a certain degree of shame over past behaviours is necessary. Because you're not ashamed of your past behavior, you're not ashamed of what you were doing. Why would you change it? And so we have this thing of, oh, there should be no shame, but it should be changed. Well, if it's not shameful, why should it be changed? If it's not shameful, it's at least neutral and possibly positive. And so why would we want them to change? It's obviously shameful, or else we wouldn't care about it. You should be ashamed that you've lost control of your life in this way. And I did some work in drug addiction, and you meet many people who have had terrible lives. Terrible, terrible lives. The fact they are using drugs is quite understandable. In the same way, the fact that quite a lot of the homeless community uses drugs is quite understandable, because you have not seen boredom like that before. But at the same time, they made their choice. People have come from terrible situations and never gone down certain roads, and to say, well, it's your environment's fault, and therefore you cannot be shamed, is, I think, going to prove in the end largely counterproductive. In the same way that only shame all the time, with no option of help or possibility of redemption, was not helpful. I think both need to be there. There is an interesting one involving suicide. People who belong to religious institutions that have strong prohibitions on suicide kill themselves less, because it's shameful to kill yourself, and there are punishments. I mean, tradition in the Catholic Church, if you committed suicide, you couldn't be buried in the same graveyard as the rest of your family. I believe you couldn't be buried on consecrated ground. And if you go back into slightly older and you look at, let's say, Dante's Inferno, I believe in Dante's Inferno there is a circle of hell purely for those who committed suicide. Now, it's been a while since I've read Inferno or Purgatorio or Paradiso, so I may not be 100% on this, but from what I remember, people who committed suicide are reborn in hell as trees, with no body, and they have the constant pain of their death, but are never able to do anything about it. And when the end times come, and everyone else is resurrected in their own body, those who committed suicide will only have their body hung from the branches of their tree, but they will remain suffering forever. Which, if you're a religious person, is a fairly strong, shall we say, idea that perhaps this is not the way to go. If you're curious why the church was like that traditionally, it was because they believed, well, firstly, that suicide was a social harm beyond yourself, but also that to commit suicide was to break the commandment that thou shalt not kill, or probably more accurately, thou shalt not murder, and that you had rejected God's gift of your life, and so you would be punished for that. Now, you might say, that's absolutely horrible. There are going to be people who are in immense mental pain because they want to kill themselves, and then they have that as well. And yes, they will. But fewer people kill themselves. So if you take fewer people killing themselves as the social good, well, that's where shame comes in. You are putting pressure on people. You are possibly harming them in order to cut down on other suicides. So you will receive a positive outcome, but potentially a negative path to get there. One that is actually shame is not going to be brought back from, because we've moved too far from it, and also because people just don't want to do it because they'd see it as just unbearable, is single parenthood. When you look at the studies on this, one of the strongest indications that someone will have a relatively successful life is that they come from what would a traditional family structure. And you can look at whether or not two parents were married before, or whether they were cohabiting. It is important that most of the research I've seen looks on basically traditional nuclear families and single parent families that were always single parent families, as opposed to single parent families that became that way due to bereavement and death, rather than that they were just never married. You can actually see the impact of this on the black community in America. If you look at how they were performing over the 20th century, they start moving up quite close to where white America was, and then they nosedive. I mean, it just progress just totally collapses. And that kind of hits into the crack epidemic and the collapse of black families after that. Some people say that's due to the increase in imprisonments amongst black males after that. Interestingly enough, the much harsher laws on crack cocaine than there are on pretty much any other drug in America, or at least were at that time, were largely driven by the black caucus in the American parliamentary system, as they were seeing an immense level of harm caused by crack cocaine. But afterwards, anyway, for for that reason, and I would say largely as a result of the social programs put in place by the American government, kind of coming together to just stomp black America right back down, black marriage is just hit the rocks. Massive fall in the amount of marriages, massive increase in single parenthood, and we know that that is in general a negative sign for the future of that child. So there is actually a very strong argument that single parents should be more shamed, that they should be seen as very much not the correct way of doing things. But there's one of your problems there. In a society, to shame someone is to argue that there is a collective responsibility, that we have a responsibility towards each other, regardless of what form of shame it is, and that people, therefore, who deviate that from that can be punished through shame, or should feel that they have been, that they should not have done that internally. And if you don't believe that, you don't believe there is a collective responsibility of that, then yes, you believe that you should live without shame and that no one should shame each other. To be perfectly honest, most of the people I have seen say that we should live without shame and to complain about people shaming them have been very quick to shame others. I would suspect that for most of them, they're not saying that there should be no shame. What they're saying is that the way that they want to live should not be shamed. So it should be fine to do what they want. The way you want to live, on the other hand, should be shamed, because it's not the way they want to live. And I would suspect that is more to it than the idea that shame should actually be gotten rid of. And that does tie into a lot of what shame is and what it requires. Shame is, by its nature, both internal shame and external shame, are limiting. They force people to live in certain ways that are seen in line, to be in line with an overarching morality or an overarching social order. We've gotten to the point where, in order to remove shame, in order to remove any potential harm or limit on people, we have just totally rejected shame as a necessary component of society. But I would point to Edmund Burke's line that man is free to the extent to which he is willing to put limits upon his appetite, and the fewer of those limits that are held within, the more of those limits there must be without. And that is to say that in a society in which the idea of shame is not accepted at all, we will see an increase in law, in government intervention, or in smaller subcultures deciding that they will actually engage in shame, for the very simple reason that shame is at its core an idea that certain things are right and certain things are wrong. And you cannot get rid of shame without getting rid of that concept. And if we don't believe that certain things are right and certain things are wrong as a society, we don't have a functioning society. We'll begin to just split apart from each other and to just, on a sort of ideological and philosophical level, move totally away from each other because there are no limits to what anyone can believe. And I think that's part of what you are seeing around the West, largely. The removal of shame has led to an incredible rise in extremism, which, interestingly enough, generally believes things and therefore has shame, but also a large part to social disintegration, because by removing shame, we remove obligation and we remove responsibility. So no one can be blamed for not doing things or told that their life choices are wrong, but no one gets support for making the right life choices. So the village does not have an obligation to help you raise your child. You do not have an obligation to help your fellow man. There's no shame if you don't do that. And if you think there is shame when you don't do that, well, you're just old-fashioned and you may engage in it yourself. But then there may be no reciprocity of that. They may never do it for you. Whereas a lot of the old-time stuff was reciprocal. It's one of the reasons capitalism is such a great system. It's because if you look at communism, communism basically says that man can be perfected, that we can remove human greed and things like that, negative, what we consider negative emotions. And if you ever talk to like old school communists about, well, after the communist revolution, what if someone says, well, I want more than I can get? They'll tell you that no one would think like that because greed is a capitalist as a result of the capitalistic structure. It's not, it's a part of human nature and innate human nature, which if you interest in history, you'll figure is pretty consistent over time. What capitalism does is it takes things like greed and anger and rage and it channels them. If you want to make money in capitalist society, if you are greedy and just openly greedy, what's the best way to do it? Well, the best way to do it is to produce something that other people want and makes their lives better. You don't care that it makes their lives better. You care that you make money. And the way to make money is by doing it. Functioning societies take negative emotions and positive emotions, and they shape them through their institutions into things which are socially beneficial. So they channel anger, the urge to kill, into certain things. They limit some of the positive emotions because those things, when they run wild, just go nonsense. And it's limiting to everyone. But because of that, the system is stable and continues to operate. And we have spent the last about 50 years just taking pieces out of the system as if it was a machine and kind of hoping it will just keep running. And I suspect that it won't, because it's not a machine. It is, as Yeats said, a tree. And you can't just cut things out of a living being and assume that there will be no impact to it. So that is what I've been thinking about recently. I'd love to hear your comments on it. You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, at the Gripped Twitter and Facebook, or you could send it to the Right Side Twitter and Facebook. I think on Twitter we're the Right Side IRL. If you think I'm talking sense, please do get in touch. If you think I'm talking nonsense, please do get in touch. If you think I am saying that we should bring back a heavy ideological cloud of shame and drive people to the point of suicide, simply shaming them for things they can't control, that's not at all what I'm saying. At all. I'm simply saying that some shame and some responsibility to your fellow citizen is probably going to be a good thing. All the best.